I was listening to the radio, my RTO. I was a Forbes Observer. And I heard the guy say, oh my God, three chopper pilots, skin alive, hanging from this tree. He said, you found what? These guys on a search and destroy mission. We found three chopper pilots, your skin alive. And I heard in the background the call sign from a higher officer saying, well, pull out, back up, and level the damn thing. And they call artillery on that place for about 45 minutes.
Well, all you get was American troops did this, American troops did that. Vietnam vet was killing kids. I killed kids. I killed 100 kids over there. I'm not proud of it, but I had to, because the NVA, the VC, were using them as shields. I seen them put on barbed wire fence and walk across. I seen a 100-year-old woman get her tits cut off, a bunch of other stuff. But the news media never put down what we have done to help that country, like building hospitals, schools, roads, farming equipment.
How do you explain to your children? We have an 8-year-old, and he comes back and says, you know, why was my daddy a hero, and now he's treated like trash? My son has gone through hell in 8 years. Right now, my husband's in the hospital, has been for 3 months. The school he goes to, the kids come up and say, your daddy must be crazy, still in the hospital. Adults, teachers, everywhere.
Bobby Brooks served in Vietnam for 2 months and 6 days in 1968. He was wounded, lost a leg, and was sent home. Dave Dye served from 1969 until 1971. Jana Hardy's husband was in Vietnam from 1970 until 1972. Had all three men not served there, they would probably never have met. Now they're all engaged in a common struggle, trying to cope with the effects of the one thing that brings them together. You won't hear a lot of war stories in this program. It's really not about the war. It's about what happened to the men and women who fought there after they came home.
Today, almost 20 years after the United States became involved in Vietnam, many questions remain unresolved. Most Americans have stopped looking for answers to those questions. But for those who fought in Vietnam, the war remains a painful and confusing experience. Legacies of Vietnam, Comparative Adjustment of Veterans and Their Peers, an 8-year, $2 million study conducted for Congress and released last year, found that most veterans, especially those who fought in heavy combat, feel their experiences have affected them profoundly.
Until you kill a person in war, you haven't done anything. The minute you kill a person in war, you're not the same anymore. You don't walk the same, you don't talk the same, you don't see the same. And you can't converse with people about the war. I can sit here and tell you all day what happened when I killed a person in Vietnam, but you will never know how I felt until you do it. You wake up at night screaming, hollering, holding on to bed, and you got to be careful with whoever's sleeping in bed with you, because you wake up choking them up or something. And you tell your kids when they wake you up to shake you by your foot, don't get too close to you, because you're scared you'll brain them with whatever you get your hand on. This is what the average Vietnam vet is going through with right now. Right now, I hear a firecracker go off and I get hysterical. When you go into war, they strip you of your own personal identity. They give you a number. Mine's RA17559745. I remember that number the longest day I live, because I didn't have a name. I had a number in the last four. B5679. That's it. 9745. That's those numbers. That's what you become. A figure. It's a statistic. And they take you and they strip you of your identity and say, okay, now you are ready to fight the war.
It's doubtful whether anything could have prepared Bobby and his comrades to fight that war. Somehow it was different. It didn't fit in with the other wars in our history, and the new experience was gained at a great cost.
If you went to Vietnam, you went on a tour. By a tour, I mean if you were in the Army, you were there for 12 months. Any branch of service, you were there for 12 months, except the Marines, and then they were there for 13 months. The bulk of Vietnam veterans didn't make their full tour. They got shot up before they got through the full tour. That became very apparent to you very, very quickly. Most of the Vietnam veterans, or it's not maybe not most, but many of the Vietnam veterans landed under fire, maybe receiving rocket fire, mortar fire, something like that. Almost all were under fire that got into combat. Almost all were under fire within a week after they were there.
Stan Hogsett is a psychologist at the Veterans Administration Medical Center in Danville, Illinois. He's worked at the Danville Center for 10 years, and most of his clients are Vietnam vets.
This was the first war we had things like search and destroy, in which you basically went out and looked for a fight. This is the first war where we had free fire zones, where anything that moved, it didn't make any difference whether you could identify what it was or not. Anything that could move, you were supposed to shoot. Whether it was a civilian or an animal or a child, anything that moved, you were supposed to shoot or had permission to. There were other areas where you didn't have permission. For example, I worked with a young man that was on what was called the fast boats, which were basically the PT boats of this particular war. And they had a rule, or they had a regulation that they had to operate under, that only a certain number of the fast boats in Vietnam, the entire Vietnam, could fire at a given time. So if you were on patrol and you started to receive fire, you had to call Saigon or Da Nang and ask who else was in a firefight at that particular time and if you could have permission to return fire. And if too many other boats were in firefights at that time, you didn't have permission to return fire. You either had to take it or you had to get out.
In combat, it was you against the world. You had to keep your guard up every minute because the fighting was all around you. You could never be sure where the enemy would be or even who the enemy was. Often you were alone. Larry Rigg, a Vietnam veteran who is a psychologist at Christie Clinic in Champaign, agrees this war was different. He says there was more alienation, more isolation.
If an army is hitting a beach, storming a beach, each individual man can look to the right and to the left and see a long line of soldiers, his peers, storming the beach right along with him. In Vietnam, these fellows would say that they would go for hours and maybe see only two or three of their own buddies. People were scattered out here and there, behind the trees, in the trees, and were constantly sensitized to the threat of just what was around the next corner, or again, behind the next tree. There were ghosts all over, which is very different than if you're in a tank along with an entire tank battalion on a desert, or, as I indicated, storming a beach. The guys felt as if they were very much alone, not just from the sense of the present physical aloneness, but the entire sense of alienation in terms of what was happening back home, the current orientation in terms of our involvement itself would produce a sense of psychological aloneness. Certainly an alienation. They felt very different, very separate, very alone.
The Defense Department thought it had taken steps sufficient to keep soldiers free of the psychological trauma that comes with being under fire. Soldiers were given shorter tours of duty and more frequent periods of R&R, rest and recuperation. Besides, the official psychiatric diagnostic manual at the time of the Vietnam War stated that war-related stress reactions would be found only in those people who were predisposed to such problems. The result, according to the Legacies of Vietnam study, was that at the height of the Tet Offensive in 1967, just 10 out of 1,000 became psychiatric casualties. Compare that with World War II, where up to 100 out of every 1,000 men were diagnosed as suffering from what was then called battle fatigue.
Following the Vietnam War, psychologists and psychiatrists began to discover that a large number of combat veterans were having reactions to stress they experienced in Southeast Asia. The Legacies study reports that today, more than one-third of the Vietnam veterans who saw heavy combat are stressed. This delayed stress reaction, also called post-traumatic stress disorder, is not a mental illness. Stan Hogsett.
Post-traumatic stress syndrome, or delayed stress syndrome, is a psychiatric category of diagnostic symptoms, which is used to classify a group of people who respond in a certain way or to certain things. It's a broad category which includes victims or survivors, since survivors is more the case, victims or survivors of any traumatic event which is very unexpected, and that can include major fires or natural disasters. For example, the people who survived the Beverly Hills Supper Club fire in Cincinnati, many have been diagnosed as having a post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, Vietnam veterans who served in combat also fit the same diagnostic category.
Most veterans have not encountered any major difficulty getting back into the swing of their lives at home, but many have or have had problems. Would these people be facing similar problems today, even if they hadn't served in Vietnam? Dr. Hogsett says no.
Some of the statistics indicate, for example, that of a similar age population that did not go to Vietnam, the divorce rate is far exceeding what would be expected by what you're suggesting, a chance operation for the Vietnam-era veteran, for the veteran in combat. The suicide rate far exceeds. The unemployment rate far exceeds. The health problems, physical health problems, particularly problems associated with stress, heart disease, cancer, that sort of thing, far exceed those persons, a similar group of people who did not go to Vietnam. So if you believe those kind of statistics, you have to assume that the Vietnam experience took some toll. Now, I did say that, you know, by far most of the veterans have been able to make some adjustments without seeking professional help. Some of them have very strong support systems, such as families, such as jobs. Maybe their families responded differently, friends. But whenever I speak in public, or whenever I do one of these things, people call me or stop by and see me, and I see a lot of people that are considered by anybody's standard very successful. And they kind of come up, and when nobody's listening or talking, they say, you know, I do still have dreams, or I still have a gun under my pillow, or I still am afraid of what I might do to my wife and children. People who are considered pillars of the community. Probably, I don't know that I ever met a Vietnam veteran that wasn't bitter about his return to the United States, and isn't bitter as he grows and matures in age and sees what happened to him as a very young person and basically how he was used. That's probably a natural course of maturation. That's probably a normal sort of response. I would imagine if you had interviewed Second World War veterans 10 to 12 years after their experience, they would have probably expressed a lot of bitterness and anger at the way their lives were disrupted, and at the way in which they may have been misled as to what was a noble cause and what wasn't a noble cause.
And
And I don't think this is right. And sometimes it brings tears to my eyes to think how my government treat me and my fellow men that fought in Vietnam. You do what they tell you to do, and after it's all over with and everything coming back, they don't want to take the time to bring you back to another transition. And you have to go through this transition in order to be able to cope with society. See, now, what we really need is a basic training for society once we come back from war. People in society don't believe that you can take, and which is right, take a man out of a war environment where he can kill just to pull a trigger, boom, you're dead. There's no decision. You don't have time to stop and let it register, who am I going to kill, you know. You go and you kill anybody that come up on the other end of that gun. If someone come up on the other end of your rifle, you kill him. And you're taught that. So once the person come back into society, he just can't rush back out there into environment where there's no guns allowed, where there's no killing allowed, no beating allowed.
I went to saw Apocalypse Now. The time I came out of that movie, I wanted to kill somebody. It's not that I want to kill the Vietnamese. It was Americans I wanted to kill. Because I didn't get no hero's welcome, no parade, anything. A tap on my shoulder. All I got was a tap on my shoulder. Yeah. A tap on my shoulder, $100. That tap from the shoulder was mine from my old man. That's the only tap on the shoulder I got.
Like, I was telling you about the book with the forgotten hero. In the last paragraph that says, when are we going to get our parade? No, they also refer to guys that fought in numerous wars throughout history. After the war, come home. Take the German soldier when he came before. Oh, this is years ago. They had to be purified and clean before he could sleep with his wife or go into his home again. He had to be purified before he could go back in that home. Once he was purified, he could go back in the home. But if he went in that home before he was purified, they had to destroy the whole home. This is their belief. And believe it or not, this belief is carried over into this generation.
The stress of the combat experience was not eased by the way the men came back to the States. In the space of a day, a soldier could go from the battlefield to the streets of his hometown. He was cut off from other vets, the only people who really could have understood what he had been through. Yet the folks at home thought they knew what the war was all about. They thought they knew because every night they watched it.
My theory is that, you see, each of them came home alone by themselves. They didn't come home in groups like every other war has. And each of them came home alone, and there was no basic deprogramming or processing out like most other people have experienced, and most of them were kind of left with what was the popular media's interpretation of a combat soldier coming back from Vietnam. And at the time when most of them came back during the war, maybe because of the 6 o'clock news and the fears that were speculated about, the popular conception was is that these will be kill crazy, out of control people. And that's what they came to believe too, because nobody was there to help them form an opinion about themselves. And as soon as they got out of the military, they got out of their clothes as quick as they could, their military clothes, and tried to meld in as much as they could and not be identified. And they didn't have anybody to talk to form an opinion or a psychological set about what they were. These were basically people who were 19 years old, which is a time we know when your identity is very much established, your adult identity, and they had nothing to go on for an adult identity other than what was being speculated about in the popular media. And it's my opinion that an awful lot of them suffer because they came to believe what the press was saying. And it has not been my experience, nor do I think really the experience of very many of my colleagues, that these individuals are necessarily dangerous. They're quite the contrary, very much in control.
Dick Shepard is a psychologist who works with vets at a veterans outreach center in Peoria, Illinois. A Vietnam-era vet, Shepard says the war became a bad idea midstream. Like Stan Hogsett, he too says the media worked against the vets. He says news accounts prevented people at home from understanding the purpose, result, and agony of the war.
The people in the States had live, in-color combat action with their supper meals. I'm sure it would be very difficult for a mother or a father or a brother or sister to picture their son or daughter or brother or sister participating in the killing action that took place in Vietnam, even if it was just killing, as happens in all wars. To even conceive that one's own blood kin could participate in such horror makes one want to not deal with the issue, and the extenuation of that is that no one wanted to deal with it. Let's not talk about it. You know, son, let's not do that now. And so the vet was left with no one who wanted to hear what had happened.
My fists. When I first got back, I thought I could take my fists and my crutches and whoop everybody into believing the way I want to believe. This is a war mentality that I had. I'm a warrior, and I don't deny that. But I have fought, I have did my job, I have served my country well. I wish to be recognized as a warrior, not as a thug, not as a dope addict, not as a drunk, but as an individual human being. Now, I think that I should be entitled to, when I walk down the street, people should be able to speak to me, "Hello, Mr. Brooks," instead of sliding around the corner or trying to get out of my way. Some people cross the street to keep from meeting me on the street. Because he's crazy. You know what they call me? They call me the war dog. Why? Because when I came home, I bought the war on my back with me. And I fought out here. I mean literally fought. Because I thought I could take my fist and beat some sense into somebody. But it don't work that way. I came home from Vietnam in 1969. I came home. Went to the VFW here in Danville to join the VFW. You know what they told me at the VFW? "We don't take blacks. We have never catered to blacks. We gave you all your own lodge over there, and you let it go down the drain." How in the hell they give it to me? I was in Vietnam. And before that, I was in Germany. Now, when I come home, I done served my time and everything. All I want to do is become a part of the community. I can't even do that.
The Legacies of Vietnam study found that positive social support is critical for vets to resolve their war experiences. Among the study's findings, married veterans are better off than unmarried vets. For veterans in large cities, having friends who are vets is important. And for those who live in small towns, having close friends in the community helps reduce stress. But the pain felt by veterans can be hard on their families and friends. It's especially rough on spouses.
In the 9 years that we have been married, my husband has nightmares. I get hit. It's not him doing it. It's Vietnam coming back that's doing it. A car backfires. He pushed me through a plate glass window.
At the Peoria Outreach Center, Dick Shepard and Bessie Weber work with families as well as veterans.
If you've ever had a child of your own who was sick and had a stuffy nose and was too young to tell you where it hurt, and they cried and they suffered, and you said to yourself, you know, "I would take that upon myself 10 times as bad if you would just take it from this child, because standing here watching is so terribly painful." And it's true with the spouse and the families of the veterans who suffer in a variety of ways. They have to sit silently, unable to help, unable to do anything, and yet the pain goes on and on and on. And in a way, in a sense, it may be worse than the pain of the experience itself.
Women traditionally have been portrayed very supportive roles in our society, and so when someone that you love is suffering, you try to support them as much as possible, only you have needs of your own that have to be met, and many times these needs are sacrificed to the extent of where the women are carrying so much pain that they need to be attended to rather quickly.
As far as my family is concerned, you know, my husband is in the hospital now, has been for the past 3 months, and the only way to fight is for me to get out and do it. Now, I have fought, I have begged in 3 months for help from different VA organizations, the VA in general, congressmen. I even called the president in Washington, D.C., and I got nowhere. People don't realize the hassle and harassment the families go through themselves. I mean, we have to learn to deal with these veterans. It's hard. They take a lot of loving, they take a lot of respect, the men take a lot of trust, and you have to stand up behind your man, or, you know, they're not going to get anywhere. My husband has been in the psychiatric ward, and I have gone in with them and met them twice, the medical staff, a nurse, a psychologist, a psychiatrist, and the social worker. And when they sit there and tell me that I should leave my husband, or they tell me to let him go home and hit rock bottom, possibly kill himself or someone else, to me, that is not treatment. People, millions of people have said, why don't you just leave your husband? That's, my husband has problems, doesn't everybody? There's not one person in this world that doesn't have some kind of problem. That is no reason to shut the door in their face like everyone else is doing. I will fight until something is done. These men cannot cope with jobs, and they say the veteran gets a job faster than anyone else. That is a bunch of baloney.
Unemployment figures for January 1982 show that veterans had a higher jobless rate than did their non-veteran counterparts. Among vets 25 to 29 years of age, 13.9% were out of work. Non-veterans in the same age group had an unemployment rate of just 11%. Of those vets between 30 and 34, 8.8% were jobless, while 7.6% of the non-veterans in that age group were out of work. Once again, veteran Bobby Brooks.
We didn't buck against the system to go over there and fight the war. Now, if we'd have bucked against the system, like Cassius Clay or Muhammad Ali, whatever you want to call him, bucked, and a few other guys left and went to Canada and places, didn't even fight. They come back, they get decent jobs, decent homes and everything, where the Vietnam vet can't go and get a decent job. He catch the devil trying to get just a piece of anything. Go to Danville, walk the streets. And all you find on the street now is poor white boys that fought in Vietnam, poor black kids that fought in Vietnam. Now, they're out on the street, no jobs or nothing. And all this cutback and everything is only hurting the Vietnam vet. That's all it's hurting. It's not hurting the guy that stayed back here. The guy that, anybody that got 14 years on a job now don't have to worry about, just about don't have to worry about getting laid off. But now, from after 14 years, 10 years on up, who's laid off? Huh? Your Vietnam vets. They come home, the heights of the 70s, the early part of the 70s, that's when all your vets come home. And you got millions and millions of vets, not only in Illinois, in every doggone state throughout the United States. They're out of jobs.
In the competition for high-level jobs, the Legacies of Vietnam study reports that veterans are much less successful than non-vets. When differences in the backgrounds of the 1,400 men interviewed for the study are statistically controlled, veterans show a disadvantage in educational and occupational attainment. Researchers conclude that duty in Vietnam has had a negative effect on post-military achievement. Vets, too, face discrimination on the job. Veteran Dave Dye.
They were hard up for somebody to take over for a guy who quit. And after I started working and everything, we went on a job. He says, Dave, we were got in a discussion about something. He says, Dave, if I didn't really need anybody, I wouldn't have hired you. And he has brought this up several times since I've been working there for 5 years. He has always brought this up. If I didn't need anybody, I wouldn't have hired you. And what gets to me is that I told him that I was a Vietnam vet. And I think that's why he's holding that on me, is that you're a Vietnam vet, and I needed somebody, but yet I don't think I want to hire you because you are a Vietnam vet. I worked for I got a fight with a colored guy out there. I lied I said, hey, I ran into something. I was afraid for my job. I didn't want to get the guy fired. Okay, they put everything on tape. And they says, well, we're going to make you have a decision. You can say you've been fired, or you can say that you quit, and we won't say anything. Okay, I said, I'll take the option of quitting. I went out and tried to get a job. I couldn't get a job. I took my little girl to a daycare center. They said, hey, Dave, I know you can't get a job or anything. You want me to call and see why you can't get a job? I said, yeah, go ahead, you know. They put down in my records that I was fired. And they got that kind of guy working out there right now. And they told me he got fired. He quit the same day I did. And I cannot step foot on that property to get my records out and see what's going on.
Ron Manaw is a veteran service officer with the Illinois Department of Veterans Affairs.
You will never get an employer to ever say that. But you can tell in some situations that that possibility may be very real. Vietnam has so many bad repercussions from it. A lot of people believe that the Vietnam veteran has a drug problem, he has an alcohol problem, or he has a lot of mental problems. Well, we have some that do have some problems, but the majority do not, as far as alcohol, drug, or mental problems. But you've got some people that are really just plain prejudiced against that era. And it's one of the things that through Department of Labor or Job Service, that they work very hard to get around that and get the Vietnam veteran hired. But, you know, with these prejudices, it's just too bad. It's very unfair. But there again, that's one of the things that the vet has to deal with, and the people that try to help him have to deal with that.
For the veterans who came home disabled, finding work can be really tough. And disability payments from the Veterans Administration may be their only source of income.
You think I feel good walking around one-legged and everybody got two legs? I'm making a lousy $1,322 a month compensation for losing my leg. Whereas if I had not lost my leg over there and came back and was a whole man right today, I could be working for some form for $60,000 a year. But I got to sell it for less than $20,000 a year because I lost my leg fighting a war that no one give a damn about. And you have to go through all this red tape for a disability. Now, when they put me on that plane to go to Vietnam, that was no red tape. And I did not hesitate. If I'd have hesitated getting on the plane, I'd have come out better. I don't believe that we should go through all this crap just for a little compensation for giving up your whole life. You know, when you go to war, you give up your whole life. Now, why is it that we come back and ask for a disability for something that happened? And so we got to go and prove it, that it happened. And your medical records are destroyed when you come back from Vietnam. Everything from your medical records are put in 513. Yes, and they want, where are you going to get proof when you don't have access to your records in the military? You have access to them, but if you take anything out, somebody's going to be chewing you out. And if you don't know about it being like this when you get out, what you going to do? And they don't tell the guys that get out. The guys get out to service, they don't tell them anything about, all right, you got to have this. You got your nose broke. You're going to need this 20 years from today when you go down and file a pension for it. You can go up. And they see you standing there with one leg. And say, yeah, what can we do for you? I want to know about my disability. How come I haven't got it? We're working on it. Now, I got one leg. It took me 6 months. I had to lose a home, a car, furniture, everything. I lost everything and started over again. Because the VA would not give me my pension. My final pay. It took them 8 months to give me my final pay from the Army.
Christie Clinic psychologist Larry Rigg says the vet's perception of the system is understandable. The veterans see the VA as an extension of the government.
And
if they are already having some negative concerns about a government who subjected them to the experience to which they were subjected, they have sort of the feeling of the chicken seeking out the fox for counsel in regards to his fear.
That's a problem Ron Menaw faces every day working for the Illinois Department of Veterans Affairs. His job is to help vets get the benefits they're entitled to by law. But at first, vets see him as just another part of the system. So he spends a lot of time trying to convince vets that he's on their side.
When a veteran enters the office and to seek out help from us, we first have to determine what type of help he's seeking. You know, it's difficult. I can see where he would think it was obvious what type of help he's seeking, but we don't know. We're not mind readers. We try to find out if he's not getting his compensation. If it's not the correct percentage, then it's our job to get this percentage or this compensation for him. If he doesn't have the correct form to file, we have files in our office that we use. If he doesn't have a DD-214, if he doesn't have a marriage certificate, then it's our job to get these documents for him. We try to do the running for the vet. What we try to do is make them feel comfortable and at ease with us so that they realize that we may be paid by the system, but we're going to do everything we possibly can to get the most out of the system for them.
Sometimes the problems become overwhelming, and a vet finds he or she needs more than help finding a job or getting a compensation check. Researchers have discovered that exposure to combat is associated with problems like drug and alcohol abuse, emotional difficulties, and medical problems. Vets who don't have the financial resources to seek treatment in the private sector must turn to the government. Some vets express dissatisfaction with the treatment they receive from the Veterans Administration. One vet, we'll call Tom, describes the problems he encountered at a VA medical center.
They're scared of us because they don't really know how to treat it. They don't know how to, they got it labeled, but they don't know how to treat it. They consider us as animals, which we aren't. We're human beings. We've got a problem. We don't deny it. We seek the help. We don't always get it. When we do get it, it's a bunch of garbage thrown back at you.
Very minute.
They treat you like an animal when you're in one of those places. They give you facilities to use. They expect you to stand around and watch TV. And then when you do watch TV, the aide says, well, fine, there ain't nobody watching. We'll just turn it over. The TV's is ours, more or less.
Veteran Bobby Brooks is also unhappy about the treatment he received. He says his therapy consisted mostly of drugs.
Yeah, like they told me when I came back, they gave me the treatment for my belligerent behavior. I love this word, belligerent. I didn't know what the hell it was until I came back to the VA. You know what they did to correct my belligerent behavior? They loaded me up with Valium, and I asked the doctor, I said, why am I taking all these pills? I got 4 pills in this cup. What are they for? Oh, they're good for you. Take them. And I found out I'm taking Valium. I'm 50 milligrams of Thorazine. It was 10 milligrams of Valium, 50 milligrams of Thorazine, and I'm walking around like a zombie. If you're going someplace for treatment for something that has really been bugging you for a while, and you go in and you sit down and you talk to someone, and they give you tell you it's all in your head, where in the hell else is it going to be but in your head?
The Legacies of Vietnam study reveals vets are hesitant to use VA facilities. Just 37% of Vietnam veterans with medical problems seek treatment at VA hospitals. Only 8% with drug or alcohol problems use VA facilities. Because of the difficulty vets have trusting the VA, and because of their special problems, Congress passed legislation establishing storefront outreach centers, especially for Vietnam and Vietnam-era veterans. The outreach centers work to help vets find jobs, alleviate emotional problems, and cut through red tape. The regional director of the VA's Great Lakes region, Al Zamberlin, talks about the importance of the outreach program.
We have established in the last 2 years readjustment counseling centers. And the number, I can't think of the number, but we have one, for example, in the Peoria area here. We have, the number must be in excess of 100. So we're trying, these are storefront units where the veteran does not have to come into a medical center such as this because it represents, you know, the federal sector. But they can avail themselves of this, what we call the storefront units, and at that time just to talk about, and most of those people there do talk about some real concerns of delayed stress, you know, maybe even Agent Orange, and the family comes in, and it's a, and eventually, once they feel comfortable that, you know, that, well, perhaps they can benefit from the intervention with the VA Medical Center, then that counselor there intercedes for that veteran and then eventually gets them into a VA environment. So the VA is trying to deal with that by not looking so awesome and just having a, literally a storefront, and those people go in there, seek counseling, and then after they receive their counseling, then they're provide the opportunity, if required, to get more medical intervention at a medical care facility.
Counselors at the Peoria Outreach Center, like Bessie Weber and Dick Shepard, are all Vietnam or Vietnam-era vets. They work to help troubled vets put their war experiences behind them.
There's no pat answer. It's like anything else. If you're dealing with a broken arm, you can usually identify the break, reset it, cast it, and barring any difficulties, it will heal itself up. It's not quite that simple with people's emotions and minds. Each person's experience in Vietnam was quite individual, as witnessed by the fact of those who are having nightmares and or flashbacks. The content is usually specific to their own particular horror. For some men, it's the horrors of combat and of the killing and of massacres, both of their own men and of the enemy. For others, it's the rain, standing in a poncho and feeling the rain patter, 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 and after a period of time, you know, just feeling overwhelmed and wanting to scream. So the particular experiences are very individual, and consequently, treatment needs to be likewise.
Something else I like to talk about, and that is the fact that the vet, the Vietnam vet, is either seen as a villain or a victim. A villain in a sense of how could you have gone over there and done all these things. Of course, atrocities are always mentioned. You know, everyone loves sensationalism. And then at the same time, oh, you poor soul, look at the hell you went through, and now we're going to try to make things better. Both of those roles really sort of imprison the veteran. That is that if the vet sees him or herself as a villain or a victim, they kind of get stuck in that place. As a villain, you know, you've put a real guilt trip on yourself, you know, thereby maybe punishing yourself for what you felt you did was wrong. As a victim, in a sense of saying, poor me, look what I went through, you owe me something, and both can be very detrimental in trying to overcome whatever emotional difficulties may be there. So I think that what we need to do together as a society, and the vet, him or herself, needs to just see it as an experience that they did encounter, a very painful and traumatic one that needs to be walked through again and left behind, and then go on with life. Not go on with life in the sense of everything will be okay as before I went over there, but go on with life in the sense that, you know, life is filled with a lot of painful, traumatic things, and how can a person best learn to cope with it and yet come out ahead of that?
Shepard says it's important for veterans to get together and talk about their experiences, but he says it can be tough to get past the anger.
There are several veterans groups who've provided a social gathering place where veterans can get together and begin to discuss some of the mutual concerns and pains and problems and so forth, and they're very good. What some of them have been reporting is that when they begin to talk, this anger that lies so close to the surface is so easily tapped. Everyone has it in them, and it becomes, you know, a majority of terrible arousal and anger and hate and pain, and it's all kind of wiped in together. The danger there is that without trained counselors who can take them through that into the next step, which is the resolution of the pain, the reintegration of those feelings into where they came from, where their appropriate place is now, and to begin to nurture that middle stage of arousal and anger and joy that have kind of lain dormant for years. In the absence of counselors like that, it's very, very difficult for the veteran to get past the anger because it's so all-consuming and so overwhelming.
For a long time, veterans have been reluctant to discuss their experiences in Vietnam. Now they seem to want to talk about it. Dick Shepherd says that's a good sign.
There's a natural defense mechanism that says, I don't want to feel this pain anymore. I've been running from this pain for 12 or 15 years. Why would I want to let myself in for more of it? Unfortunately, the process of letting it go involves taking it back out again, looking at it, and instead of it being a spook in the closet that comes out at its own beck and call and haunts and horrifies, it can become a bad memory that can be put in a box and put up on the shelf in the closet so that it needn't be something that rules one's life. It'll never be okay. It'll never be, well, I can feel okay about the war now. But it also needn't be the terrible horror. In a setting of caring and compassion and openness and able to talk, the veteran also or often seems able to transcend the point where the anger leaves them so quickly and go on to appropriate angers, appropriate feelings, how this fits into their daily life, and again reawaken some of those feelings that they've not been able to share. They've not been able to show even a little bit of anger for fear the great big anger will come out. So sometimes we smilingly say to ourselves, well, it seems it was the air. Whatever it was, for some reason the veteran seems to be feeling better and is reporting the same.
It's not easy for vets to resolve their memories of the war in Southeast Asia. And it's not easy to listen to much of what the vets are saying about their experiences and their feelings. Perhaps as a result of that, the vets who are speaking out are sometimes labeled crybabies. Ron Menoff, the Illinois Department of Veterans Affairs, says that's unfair.
You know, they are vocal. They have a right to be vocal. They did something for this country. When this country asked them to go, they went. And I think they have every right to make it known their problem. And the federal government has an obligation to these veterans. If they have a true, real problem that was created or caused by the military service, then it's the federal government's obligation to take care of that. As far as the civilian that looks at the Vietnam vet and considers him a crybaby, it's very unfair. That individual wasn't through what the Vietnam vet was through. You know, it's so easy for people to criticize others. Sometimes you're better off if you just stand back and listen to what he has to say. We have some people that use profanity and really blow it out of proportion. But there's a lot of problems that the vet complains about or is trying to bring to the surface that are very real. And it's just like, say for an example, the Agent Orange, which is one of our real big problems right now. The scientific world can't even agree on this problem, you know, to what extent that Agent Orange will or has affected that vet. And if the Vietnam vet, if he stops talking about it, then that issue or other issues may die. And as well as anyone should know, when you get into any kind of problem and you're trying to get laws or Congress to act on it, the first thing you do is get petitions signed and you get to the right people. And the Vietnam vet is basically, he's kept pretty quiet until about the last 2 years. And then he's really gotten vocal. But it's about time. And as long as he's not doing any physical damage or using the system in a bad way, then I see no harm in it. You know, the thing of it is, a lot of vets, I'm not talking about the Vietnam vet, but there are some vets that feel that the federal government owes them, and that irritates a lot of people. But you got to realize what that individual gave up and what he's going through now. I was in during the Vietnam era, and I was in Germany. I feel the federal government owes me nothing. But if I would have contacted some rare disease, Agent Orange, or lost a leg, I would certainly feel that they owe me something. You know, it's typical, and I think any Vietnam veteran or any veteran would point blank tell you they don't want any more than what they deserve or what the law will allow. Of course, that doesn't stop us in trying to get a law changed. It's a difficult situation, but I feel people should really stop and think about this before they criticize them. Because most of them, there's very few that anybody could ever term as a crybaby. Because, you know, they've done a lot and they've given up a lot. I'm surprised we don't have more problems than what we have.
Again, Jana Hardy and Bobby Brooks.
Mainly the Vietnam veterans or Vietnam era veterans, all we want in families, all they want is respect, decent treatment. Just we want to make it known that the problems the Vietnam veterans are having are real problems, not something that can be thrown aside or just forgotten. You've got to realize that these guys went over there, they killed, they slept in filth, they went through hell. But the proper treatment with someone who has been there, that understands, and not this if you speak up will lock you up, they may be able to cope with it, but it will never be completely out of their systems.
Really, I don't have a complete grip on everything about society right now, because I don't like the way that I see things happening here. I don't like. And the first thing to come to a vet's mind, get a gun, clean it up. Right now, like I say, I'm over the hill. I know I'm through. But my son is going to face his dilemma sooner or later down the road. And if everyone is aware of it, what is going on with the warrior, you can't take a live human being and put him in a box and put him away until the next war. And the thing it is, they're forgetting one thing for sure. There will be another war. And my son is not going to want to go and fight when they seen what they did to his daddy. So my daddy, when he came back, nobody even wanted to speak to him because he's a Vietnam vet, baby killers and stuff like this. Everybody has, they label us everything but human beings.
In the words of the Legacies of Vietnam study, American society ultimately gains from Vietnam veterans' efforts to derive significance from the confusion and pain still associated with that conflict.
But it is fair to say that most of the working through of this war is yet to be done. I'm Celeste Quinn.
And I'm David Inge.